Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The show is about to begin.
Welcome to the podcast, Conscience That Made Us. Interviews and stories, tales from the bus. We love taking you back to when it all went down. The greatest live shows and the cheering crowd sound. It's Concerts, Concerts That Made Us, ConcertsThatMadeUs.com.
Hey guys, this is Dave from Fear of Water, and you are listening to Concerts That Made Us.
Dave Perry, you're very welcome to Concerts That Made Us.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you now. I'm really looking forward to diving into your music over the next bit. So Fear of Water's two last releases are unreal. Total bangers. First of all, I'd love to dive into Systemic, which features Aaron Nordstrom from Gemini Syndrome. What can you tell us about it?
First, I'm super happy with it. Like, it takes a long time for one of these songs to go from an idea that I come up with this room that I'm sitting in to it being a finished recorded product that has a featured artist. So I wrote Systemic the day that Roe v. Wade got overturned in America. And it's specifically about, it's not about picking a political side. It's about the fundamental principle of having that separation of church and state. And I think people think about that in a more literal way, like no prayer in school, which I also agree with. But this to me is much more important, where it's very clear that religion, and specifically in this case, the Christian religion, although there are many religions that would align with this type of philosophy, is strongly influencing Supreme Court justices' decisions, which, I mean, it's such an enormous conflict of interest. Like, if you truly believe that we have a creator, but he's actively watching and judging and making a list about who gets into his house or not, of course it's going to have an enormous impact on the way that you live your life, including ignoring things that you specifically as a Supreme Court justice are in a place to uphold. Not just a place to uphold, you're literally, the buck stops with you. You are the last line of legal defense to ensure that founding father principles stay in place. And the overturning of Roe v. Wade, as well as other things that are happening, it's so obvious that they're just like, well, fuck that. I'm prioritizing my faith over a 250-year-old rule. So when I started writing it and got into like the musical meat of it, I immediately was like, Aaron from Gemini Syndrome would sound amazing on this. I had no contact with him whatsoever. I had no, oh, well, Steve knows. I'm like, I had no contact whatsoever. But as I was writing it, I'm a big Gemini Syndrome fan. I think, like, I like the band Gemini Syndrome, but Aaron specifically just has a really cool, unique voice. And it's just very versatile, very good with vacillating between, like, he can do soft and sensitive and vulnerable and quiet and transition into very, very powerful, but still, I mean, he can do like guttural screaming. He can do melodic, aggressive singing. But yeah, there was just something about it as I was writing it that I was like, I wasn't even like, how do I get Aaron on the song? Just as I was writing, I was like, that would be cool. And then flash forward, several years later and the song is getting completed. I've honestly just been lucky with initially kind of cold calling people, either directly or I'll have one person. I was like, hey, you did one tour with Gemini Syndrome like 4 years ago, right? Like, do you still have his number or whatever? So that has worked out well. And what's happening now, because I've done features with Marcos from El Nino, Elias from Nonpoint, Heidi from Butcher Babies, Aaron from Gemini Syndrome. The next one I have coming out is with Clint from Seven Dust. So like just the fact that those exist and then the fact that they're doing well from a streaming standpoint, social, radio play, test drive on Octane is kind of, it's like the snowball's gaining momentum as it's going down the hill in terms of, I'm not this like super connected industry vet type thing, or I have like my labels like reaching out for me. It's just been like very grassroots networking. So I'm super happy for anyone that ends up partnering with me on any of these creative endeavors, but especially this first wave of artists, because for all intents and purposes at that time, you've never heard of me. We don't have any sort of like, you really have no reason to work with me other than you like the music that much that you would want your name attached to it. And I think that all of these collaborations have turned out phenomenal. And I take it as a great sign of respect for me. I have such a deep level of appreciation for it. And I hope to pay that forward if I'm ever in that position someday. But yeah, Systemic is, you know, it came together really great. Aaron, it was cool having like a collaborative conversation with him about the meaning of the song and his performance. He actually completely changed the key of his, like the song was done when I sent it to him. And then he sent his part back. Like I took the vocal performance out and gave an instrumental version. What he sent back was in like a totally different key than what I recorded, which I would have never thought of, but I was like, this is fucking great. Like, this is exactly why I want to work with Aaron from Gemini Singer, because he's going to view the music through a lens that I have not or will not. And also him and everyone else I've worked with have been super supportive in terms of, you know, in theory, they could just like do the song and be like, cool, see ya. But everyone has been really involved with like making studio performance videos and posting about it, not only on their individual social, but the band social, and like from like a networking perspective. And it just, it's been great. Like, there's just been a very, like, I've been doing music for a long time. And as part of doing music for a long time is having a lot of failure or false starts or just kind of coasting, or, you know, one step forward, two steps back. And there's just been some really great momentum in the last, you know, kind of basically coming out of quarantine. During quarantine, I really cracked down. I was like, life's short, man. Like, literally the whole world can stop moving without giving notice. And I just knew that coming out of quarantine, I was like, I need to, if this is what I want to do with my life, I need to start doing it in a substantive way. Up until that point, it was mainly doing music for myself. And then occasionally be like, hey, you know, can I do shows? Like, I'll put out an album when I have time or whatever. But coming out of quarantine, it's just basically been like, let's fucking do this. And so, you know, started working with a lot of producers that I really respect. And then every single song that I've done, you know, since 2022 is going to be a single with a featured performer. So anyways, that was a very long-winded answer. But, very proud of Systemic, very appreciative of Aaron for being a part of that.
That's crazy though. That's, you know, I'm sure to people on the outside, it looks like a bit of overnight success. And the fact you're getting these artists as well, it's just, it looks, from my point of view, it looks like you have like a queue of great singers, famous singers, whatever, lining up around the block. I have to ask, who's your dream person to work with then?
So I have like a realistic answer. I have like an attainable answer and then like a dream answer. The attainable answer is Clint Lowry. And I wouldn't even, when I say attainable, I'm only saying because I have already done it. I wouldn't have thought that before that time. So like ever since I was a teenager, my like top three just musical inspirations as a whole, not just like someone on their individual craft or because of what they did with this band or this album, but like a whole career of music, would be, it's Trent Reznor, Dave Grohl, Clint Lowry. They're all multi-instrumentalists who have persevered for decades. And it's not just the longevity of the career, it's the fact that they've gone through essentially, they came out of the absolute peak of the traditional record industry, late 80s, early 90s, through the total disintegration of it and reforming. Like, if you can be a band that was around in the early 90s and survive Napster becoming a thing, and then completely pivot and evolve to be more focused on, to still put out albums, but know that if you're, in terms of selling music, you're basically making more money on selling singles than entire albums, which can be very demoralizing as an artist. You know, the amount of thought and intention that goes into making a well-rounded, cohesive, even thematic piece of art that's an album. And then you see like, well, people really only wanted two songs on this, so they gave me $1.98 and the rest of it's sitting on the shelves. So to pivot through that, to lean more into touring, to you know, get into merch to all three of those guys have definitely pivoted into like other avenues. I mean, Clint has had like 5 or 6 different bands. Dave has become a New York Times bestselling author and has made documentaries and has produced and has opened up his own studio. Trent is doing Academy Award winning soundtracks. Like, I've just, my entire life, I found those three men to be a total guiding light in an oversaturated world full of copycats. And yeah, it's pretty amazing to be sitting here telling you, you know, 20 years later that I have, that one of my next singles is with Clint Lowry. And that even after, I feel very fortunate that, so like we did this song together, which is called Shame. And then he knows Kyle O'Dell, who is the engineer that I've been working with in Nashville. And during the process of working on Shame, I told him I'm going to Nashville next week. I'm spending 2 weeks there. Typically when I go into the studio, I have like, these are finished songs, make them sound better, go. And this was more like, I'm going to go to Nashville and write 5 songs with a guy that I've never met before, but is very, he has the accolades. He has #1 songs. He comes highly recommended. And Clint ended up being a part of that process as well. So he co-wrote 3 more songs with me. He's not featured on it, but like he was involved in the creative process. And again, I was just like, this is wild. Like, this is, what's crazy is that like, it's like, I'm more happy about it now as I'm describing it to you, but in the moment it was stressful as fuck. Like the song usually, so I'm like systemic, incredibly proud of it. Because it's like a done song. Like it's a song that I've been like, oh, this checks all the boxes. It's as polished as I want it to be. Like it's literally a finished product. Are you a musician?
Somewhat. I tinker with guitar and drums a little.
Sure. So there's something very vulnerable about like just picking up a guitar and noodling in front of anyone, let alone like a musical idol. You know, it's one thing to be like, I have this finished product that I put an unbelievable amount of time into and it's been refined and polished and I checked with someone else and they gave me feedback and I implemented that. And then I had a master guy do it and he made it sound even better than I could. Like, it's the total opposite of that. So like, it's total like bare bones, all of my flaws on display. And then also like, for one of the first times in my life, I had like writer's block, which is like, it's just not a thing for me. Right. But there were so many factors going on in terms of being in Nashville, working with a guy that I've never worked with before, creating music from scratch with the like active involvement of this guy that I have so much admiration for. The end result is phenomenal, like incredibly proud of it. But those 2 weeks felt like 2 years of, I mean, I remember just even coming home from the studio each day and being like, look, fuck, like just sitting in my Airbnb and be like, why can't I come up with a melody for this? Or like, why can't I get my head wrapped around a good, you know, vocal syncopation for the verse? Or like, why can't I think of something more interesting than this straightforward bridge that we have now? Like being a one man band has the pros and cons of that are on this very opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of the satisfaction that I get of completing a song or an album where it's 100% on me is unbelievably fulfilling. You know, I listen to something, I'm like, I'm literally like 100% of the sonic elements that are coming through the speaker right now are of my creation. It's the culmination of a literal lifetime of dedicating myself to these instruments and studying songwriting. And it's such a big part of me as a whole that goes into every single song that having a finished song that I'm proud of is hard to put on a level with literally anything else in life. That's the good end. The bad end is that everything leading up to that is horribly stressful and makes me doubt myself constantly. Cause there's no one else to blame. Not good. If song doesn't get done, if the song's going slowly, if it's unoriginal, whatever, like it's solely 100% my fault. So, and I deal with that in this room when I'm by myself. So dealing with that in Nashville at an expensive studio, working with one of my idols, like It's a lot, dude. And again, I'm very thankful for the opportunity. It's amazing just to have music that I've created with an actual like lifelong inspiration. But holy shit, man, it was like running a marathon. You cross the finish line in a marathon. You're like, oh my God, I did it 26, whatever miles. But like those 26 miles was like, kill me.
I could imagine.
Yeah.
Are you very tough on yourself then? Like when you finish a song and it's out there, do you kind of look back at it and criticize it as if, oh, I should have done this here? Or are you like, no, it's out. I'm proud of it. It's in the past.
Well, it coming out, it does not make me proud of it. The obsessive level of, I will listen to a song 800 or 900 times before it sees the light of day. Like I will be so almost like OCD level surgical about listening to it on my phone and these headphones and earbuds and a car sound system and listening it on studio monitors and then listening to everything else in the world except for this and then coming back to it and seeing how does that feel, how's the volume, how's the low end. I really like getting feedback from musical peers, specifically people that I know will criticize me, like will give me constructive criticism. I'm not sharing music so you can be like, dude, you're so good. Like I want you to tell me the things that I'm not hearing. Everyone hears music differently. Music is, the enjoyment of music is subjective, but then there's objective things in terms of like frequencies that shouldn't be a part of a certain song that can like, you know, a high end that hurts your ear or a low end that's so prominent that the syncopation of the guitars is getting eaten up. Like, and then there's also just like the opinion of like, is this catchy or is it not catchy? Or sometimes people come with an idea, it could be something simple, like you should do a double chorus at the end. Or if you did halftime in this section coming out of the solo, or what if you brought the pre-chorus back, as you know, like structural things. Creating music is not a collaborative process for me, but the like refinement of it before it becomes a finished thing that sees the light of day is, I wouldn't say democratic, but it's collaborative. So anyways, to answer your question, by the time that it comes out, I've heard it so many times in so many different scenarios. I've answered so many questions, addressed so many doubts that by the time it sees the light of day, I'm like, yeah, it's good. Like I molded the shit out of this piece of coal to make it a diamond, at least in terms of what I think it is. I would never, ever release something that I am anything less than incredibly proud of, that I would stake, I don't want to say like stake my entire career on it, but I would put it up against any other thing that's on Octane or something like that. Like certainly at this point, like with the current strategy of these singles with featured performers where I have super talented producers and or engineers at the helm. Before that, it was like during quarantine, I did a 19 song album and I did it entirely here with no one else. You know, like I'm a much more talented musician than I am engineer.
Right.
And while I'm proud of that album, especially because it was the byproduct of like, I live alone and doing 4 or 5 months of quarantine by myself was like a lot.
Yeah.
And that album like really saved me. So, and I'm proud of the songs, but just if remove all of that emotional context, I would never want any of that. If I'm putting my best foot forward and want to like sell myself to like a label or a management group or get put on Octane, it would be none of that music. So like starting from that point, all of these individual songs are like, it needs to be big league, you know, it needs to be as best as it can possibly be. And that's also part of the reason why I'm doing singles, is because I can put that much thought and effort into an individual song, as opposed to like, if I was doing that for an entire album, I wouldn't put anything out for 10 years. So,
true. Yeah. Now as well, which makes your story even more incredible, is we often hear people say music changed my life. But for you, it's even more so. You were actually born deaf and music was critical in your recovery. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. So I was born what would be called clinically deaf, in the way that So I'm wearing glasses right now. I have, my eyes are less than perfect. I'll say that. I would never drive a car without wearing glasses. And by the state's definition as well, I'm like required to wear corrective, as are millions of other people. But like, I think when I talk to people about this, it's kind of hard for them. People think about deafness in a very binary way, right? You either can hear or you can't. And if you can't hear, that means you're deaf. It's more of a spectrum in the way that eyesight is a spectrum. So I was born clinically deaf, where I had really extensive overlapping double ear infections that were occurring, basically coming like out of the womb. I was already impacted by this, and it just kept getting worse, and it went unaddressed for a long time because it's not a standard thing that babies deal with. Like, they could tell that I wasn't responding to audio stimuli, but then that's like, okay, is he actually deaf? Maybe he's on the autism spectrum. Like, there's a lot of other things. And this went on for a long time, and it was finally addressed, but then like aggressively treating serious infections in an infant is a very delicate dance. Because you know, the immune system is essentially not there, and babies can react, have a very adverse effect, a reaction to a lot of medications and whatnot. So this struggle went on for years, and it included hardcore medication and surgeries and years of speech therapy. And so I essentially wasn't really talking until I was about 5 or 6. And that also, it just had an enormous cognitive impact on me in terms of, at the time that kids are learning like basic arithmetic and how to learn a clock and tying their shoe and just beginning to learn cursive and stuff like that. I'm just beginning to develop language skills. And it's super frustrating. And I was acutely aware of the fact that I was behind everyone. So I get my language skills. I'm, you know, fully talking by age 6, but then I literally have like 5 years of catch up to play. And it was everything. I couldn't read a clock, couldn't remember the difference. I couldn't like absorb the difference between right and left. I couldn't tie my shoes. My short-term memory was garbage. Mathematical concepts were like impossible to me. There was even some words still that I couldn't say. Like, it was just very clear to me that like my brain was not functioning as it should. And then that of course was being reflected in my grades. I failed every single grade from first to fifth grade.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the school system I went to, the school leaves it up to the parents. Like, should we hold him back or should we push him forward? You know, if we push him forward, it's only going to get more difficult. So I'm thankful that they pushed me forward. But yeah, basically I was becoming more and more aware of how not good my brain was. And it seemed to only be getting worse as everyone's getting further ahead. And so I kind of just started diving, not kind of, I completely was like, fuck school. I'm going to just, music is my thing. Like, I was already gravitating towards music for like an emotional release. But I thought just like, I can't do all of these other things that all of these kids around me are doing. So I'm going to try to create or play or whatever, learn music if I can't learn anything else. And that was an incredibly difficult process as well, just like everything else. A big thing for me was, I had no ambidexterity or polydexterity. Like, my arms and legs could not operate independent of each other, which is critical for playing drums. And that's what I started with. And it was incredibly frustrating to like watch a music video and hear the song and be like, I know what you're doing. I know that like, you got the you're hitting the kick drum on the one and the snare drum on the two, and your right hand is hitting the hi-hat 4 times. Like, I get all of that. And then I sit down to do it and it just can't happen. It was very reminiscent of speech therapy where, you know, the therapist would be like, can, and I would understand that it's a can. I don't understand the C sound that she's making. I didn't know how to spell can. I could hear her saying can. I saw it written out. Like, I had all those pieces, and then when it came my turn to just say it, my brain would literally like short circuit. And it was like basically having a stutter. So at this point, I'm having like a musical stutter. And I was like, I just became literally obsessed with like, I have to get over this. So I didn't even have a drum set. I literally would just like air drum on pillows or whatever. And I have this very vivid memory of my family's driving to Florida from Wisconsin, the spring break of sixth grade. And I'm listening to Metallica on my Discman in the back of this van. And I'm listening to the same song over and over and over again. Has this super straightforward drum beat, and I'm in the back of the van and I can't fucking separate my right arm and my right leg and my left. It's just, I'm used to the frustration at this point, but I'm like, I'm going to just keep doing this over and over and over again. And around like the no joke, like 80th time, I experienced this incredible pop inside of my head. And the only thing I can compare it to is like when your ears pop on an airplane, but times 10. And I like threw my headphones off. Like I'm the youngest of three brothers. It felt like one of them like punched me in the back of the head, but I was in the back seat. So that was not possible. And I'm kind of like looking around, like what the fuck just happened. I kind of 5 minutes later, I was like, calmed down, got my shit together, put the headphones back on, push play, exact same song. And I started going, I'm like, oh my God, the strings have clipped. Like, and I've since talked to, a neurologist about this, and what I experienced is what stroke victims can experience, or like people with like massive head wounds, in that it's literally synapses finally breaking through some like scar tissue or whatever kind of cognitive barricade. There's an actual like electrical impulse inside of your brain on a regular basis. And when something like that happens and a true breakthrough happens, it actually like has a physical response.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, dude, it's crazy. And so we get to Florida and, you know, family's like, hey, let's go to the beach. I'm like, fuck that. I'm just going to sit here with my book of CDs and be like, oh my God, I can play Offspring and I can play Nirvana. And like, that's all I did for 1 week of vacation. And then all the way back, you know, driving from Florida to Wisconsin. And then all I'm thinking about is, oh my God, I've just opened up this whole musical world to me. This is incredible. Fuck school. But then I get back to school, and the first day I go back, I could read the clock and I could tie my shoes. And I was like, of course this is left. And of course this is right. And my short-term memory worked, and I started learning cursive immediately. And it just, what happened in my brain because of music unlocked everything. And ever since then, I'm not that I'm like a genius or anything like that, but I've excelled academically ever since then. And that seemed like such a irrefutable proof that music, it's not like, I don't see it as fate, but like, obviously music has more of an impact on me, literally, physically, than anything else in life ever had or could or will. And aside from my just already existing enjoyment of music, I was like, I've literally been given this unbelievable, profound gift from music as an ethereal whole. It just solidified my relationship with music from that point. I was like, it would be insane of me to not fully acknowledge the power music has had on me and given me. And from that point forward, it's like, I'm going to learn as many instruments as possible. I'm going to just do everything I can to fully immerse myself in music. And that's, yeah, that was the beginning of my journey, but it's pretty incredible, man.
Holy crap, dude. You know what? We need like a biopic made about your life. That would be like, that'd be unreal.
So there is this movie that came out a couple years ago. I think it was nominated for Best Picture, but it's called Sound of Metal. Have you heard of that?
No, actually.
You definitely check it out. It's a very sad kind of reverse of this, of my story. And it's about a drummer going deaf after years of gigging and not taking ear protection seriously. And it's about having that entire sensory world taken away from you, specifically music. And then there's that added element to it of that he's covering heroin addict, and his music career is like what's keeping him on the straight and narrow. And then he loses his hearing, and the movie does a phenomenal job. I don't even know how I would describe it. Like if I was sitting in a room with a director or a writer or something, and they said, describe hearing loss. Like, what does hearing loss sound like? Is a very, that's like me saying, do you, tell me about a color that doesn't exist.
Yeah. You
know, some sort of like cognitive exercises. I don't even know how to articulate that because it's, you're asking me to describe the lack of sense. And because there, I experienced a transition too, except mine went from hearing loss to gaining hearing. And this movie does a phenomenal job of depicting the loss of such a critical sense and really highlights the profound impact that that can have, especially on a musician. The movie also does a phenomenal job of helping the viewer understand that deafness is not a, it's not a disease. And in fact, the deaf community very much so views that as like their culture, and sign language is, it's their language. It's not like a trick. It's not like a tool. Like, well, I can't talk, so let's just figure out. It's literally their language in the same way that English is our language.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting friction in the movie of the main character. All he wants is to get a cochlear implant to try to like get his hearing back. And he joins this like, he basically goes into like a recovery community that's for deaf people. And all he can talk about is, you know, I need to make money so I can buy a cochlear implant. And all of these other deaf people are like, it's, I'm trying to think of a more respectful example, but that's like me being like, oh man, I really don't want to be white. I have to not be white anymore.
Right.
They're like, this is, we are deaf. Like, it is who we are. This is our community. This is our language. This is our culture. We have a history. We have authors and musicians and dancers. Like, this is who you are now. It is a reality. And so to be obsessed with like changing that and getting a cochlear implant is actually insulting to the community. So anyways, it's a phenomenal movie. It's a very difficult watch. It's a very sad subject material. But certainly as someone who came from the position that I just told you, if nothing else, all musicians should watch it to appreciate the fucking importance of hearing protection. I still, the amount of like guys that I've gigged with, or even people who go to shows and they'll maybe put like toilet paper in their ears. I'm like, get earplugs. Like your hearing is too important to not. And if you really care about like sound quality, you can get incredible frequency specific filtered earplugs. Like Eargasms are good for this. I have custom ones made, even custom ones that were like specifically molded to the shape of my ear. It was only like $150. Not that that's a small amount of money, but considering it's something,
it's not
that
bad either.
Yeah, I'll have it forever. Concerts sound amazing and don't hurt. I could stand right next to the fucking big monitors at a huge venue and I'll be fine. So anyways, the importance of protecting your hearing is everything. So Sound of Metal, check it out. It's good.
I'll have to. And you know, the podcast is called Concerts That Made Us. So I have to ask you some concert related questions. I'm looking forward to. First off, as a concert goer, what concerts have made you?
I feel like I have my own immediate thought of like what that means, but this being your show and you know, you obviously chose the name and you've done many of these interviews, like in what sense do you mean made? Like what kind of impact are we talking about?
You know, kind of opened your eyes. You first showed it, you're like, holy crap, this has just blown me away. This is what I want to do.
So the first real concert I went to was I saw Metallica when I was in second grade, and it blew my fucking mind, dude. Like it's like seeing the ocean for the first time in that you can't actually had this experience recently with my 7-year-old niece, where we went to Costa Rica together, and where she lives normally, she lives by a lake that's pretty big. And this is her first time seeing the ocean. And she's like, is this like the lake? And I was like, I don't even know how to articulate to you how much this is not like the lake.
Yeah.
And I had to like, I was like, it goes, you know, you see, look as far as you can see, that's nothing. Like, and then I pulled out a map and like zoomed out to the whole world. I was like, all of this blue is what we're looking at right now. And that like blew her mind. So like before seeing Metallica, I'd been to like the state fair and like, you know, a coffee shop or something, or like something at church or whatever. But then I see this Metallica show, a sold out, you know, 60,000 person arena with pyro, and dude, I was just, it was incredible. And there's this, before the encore, they had this orchestrated thing where like one of the crew guys, there's like an explosion in the rafters. And one of the crew guys like falls and like hits the ground. And as soon as he hits the ground, the entire venue goes pitch black. And then this like solitary, like 35 watt bulb comes down from the ceiling, and James Hetfield comes out and like turns it on and starts playing, you know, Fade to Black.
Yeah.
I mean, goosebumps thinking about it. It just like, I left that. I was like, holy shit. Dude. Like, you know, that wasn't, I didn't leave there being like, I need to be Metallica, but it was like, I just, it was like seeing the ocean. I was like, oh my God. Like, I thought lakes were big. And then I saw the ocean. Then I realized that it's most of the planet. Like, yeah, that was big. Other shows that like, so two bands that have consistently blown me away live in stage presence, sound, which is, you know, also the crew is such an integral part of sound, but you know, having good songs is the first part. How they translate live is a whole different thing. And then certainly like stage, like visuals, the light design, pyro, use of screens and technology. Those two bands are Nine Inch Nails and Muse. And holy shit, man. Like I've seen them so many times, and fortunately in a wide variety of venues as well. Nine Inch Nails did a club tour, on the With Teeth album. So that'd be like 2005-ish. And this is during a period of time where they could sell out Madison Square Garden four nights in a row. But they did this thing, like, we're going to play 2,000 person venues. And I've also seen them, you know, at Red Rocks and, you know, huge venues and Mixing, you know, Lollapalooza, just like all these different things. And it's been so consistently like such a professional, well-rounded, incredibly visceral production, that every time I walk away from one of those concerts, I'm just like, the bar just keeps going up. And some people get discouraged by that. I think it's more so maybe not from an audience perspective, but I think other players definitely tend to, it's maybe a jealousy thing, an ego thing or whatever, but certain people be like, I don't know. My philosophy is that there will always be someone, if not many people, way better than you at whatever you do, unless you're in the rare scenario that you are, you know, a Stephen Hawking or whatever. Like, you, there are very few people who are the best at what they do.
Yeah.
I fully accept that I'm not, and not only does it not discourage me, it inspires me. Like, every time I leave any good show, the first thing I do is go home and pick up a guitar. It inspires me so much, and I feel very fortunate that I'm in a that I have a relationship with music now that I can do that. You know, earlier in life, seeing a good concert would drive my hunger to learn more, right? Like, it has taken 25 years of teaching myself all of these instruments to get to the point where I am now. And that requires, it's so frustrating, dude. Like, it is frustrating to be really bad at an instrument for a long period of time. And progress is, unless you're like a virtuoso or something, which I'm not, it's incredibly slow. And my progress has been incredibly slow, but for like the better part of three decades. And I needed things to fuel that because I didn't have like huge wins. I wasn't like, do you remember the band Harvey Danger? They did a Flagpole Sitta.
Yeah.
In the 90s. Okay. Those guys, none of those guys played any instruments before writing that album. And they went to like a thrift store and bought like shitty second, third hand instruments. And then they're like, okay, all right, this is an E chord. Like they just, and again, like the music is very simple. They're not like, it's not like a Dream Theater album or something like that. But they literally just like the project that they had is let's go buy shitty instruments, learn really basic music, and then try to write something also very basic. And they totally succeeded.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was a very frustrating process, but they had the reinforcement of like, oh shit, people love this goofy flagpole city song. I didn't have that. And I didn't have that for 20 years. So I need something like Amazing Concerts to
inspire
fuel that creative fire. Yeah. And I should say that, like, so all these examples I'm giving are these enormous scale productions. Also, like, there's this acoustic guitar player, Andy McKee, that I really love. And I've seen him in like 30 person venues. And he's, I think, one of the most talented musicians alive. And maybe even more so in that kind of setting where I'm like, literally, we're like in the same room. Like, I have eye contact with you. Like, that is a profound experience where I'm almost hearing, I'm hearing the natural sound off of your guitar sitting directly in front of you more than I'm hearing it in the monitors for the room. Yeah. There's something really special about that. Or even going to, I live in Austin, Texas. There's a few really good, like, dingy jazz clubs. And I'm not a jazz musician, but like, it's fucking cool to go and watch people create. You know, so much of jazz is improvisation, and just to like sit there with a cocktail for an hour and watch these incredible players talking to each other. You know, they know the like basic chords of a song, and then they just riff on it for 7 minutes or whatever. And like, that's cool, man. Like, I don't know. I guess this is an interesting like terminology question for you. Like, is there a difference between a concert and a show, or a concert and a performance? Like, is Nine Inch Nails at Red Rocks, is that a concert? And is, you know,
Mary
Jive and the Uptown Five, is that a show? You know what I mean? Is there a difference?
You know, I kind of feel like there is, but for the podcast, I use it as an umbrella term. But I feel like in real life, away from the podcast, if I'm going to a club, I'm going to a show. If I'm going to an arena, I'm going to a concert. You know what I mean? There is, I suppose, kind of a difference.
I agree with that, for sure. And live music is incredibly inspiring to me. Just the human interaction, and this is why AI can absolutely go fuck itself, that there will never be... It is impossible for AI to accomplish what the interpersonal connection of me playing guitar and you hearing it in front of me. Yeah. So even if it's not a concert, I'm still just am incredibly, it's just amazing to know that even though there's a lot of music that sounds very similar to other music, there's also music out there that you hear and you're like, what fucking planet are you from, dude? Because I'm working with the same, I have a guitar next to me. I'm working with the same six strings and set of tunings and similar effects or whatever. And then Steve Vai comes out and my brain is dripping out of my ears. I'm like, what? And that's a guy, Steve Vai is someone I've seen many times live. And I'm just like, dude, like, it's like, I know for a fact that I'll never get to that level, but I also know for a fact that he will inspire me for my entire life. And there's something really beautiful about that. So
yeah, definitely. And shows you've played, then, is there, if you think about them, is there one that sticks out above the rest as the highlight?
It's tough. There are performance moments. It's hard to say one. Because certain moments mean more to me for different reasons. So in 2022, Raw, so I'm the drummer, the drummer for the band Raw. Most people would know them for the song Do You Call My Name, which came out in 2002. And I was a junior in high school when that came out. So I was not in the band at that time. But if you told 17-year-old Dave that 37-year-old Dave would be touring the country on the 20th anniversary of that album, I'd be like, that's bullshit. but we headlined at the Whiskey in LA, and that's like the fucking Led Zeppelin played on that stage, dude. Like, the Who played on that stage. Like, that's
the Doors.
Like, But yeah, the Doors, man. Like, literally, I just got goosebumps when you said that. Like, music royalty has been on that stage, and that club has just it's hallowed ground. And to headline there and like, whatever, it sounds kind of shallow, but like I just stood there and like saw that, like the name on the marquee is like, dude, fuck yeah, man. Like I was just like, it's like, dude, yes, like. Because that tour also had like some total turd shows, you know, like
right.
Tuesday night, Joplin, Missouri, the promoter fucked up. I'm making all this up, but like, you know, there'd be something where like all of the thing, you know, inclement weather, sound guy was terrible, sound check, whatever. Just like, this was the opposite of all of that. And even when I'm playing, I'm like, oh shit, there's Doc Coyle from Bad Wolves is watching right now. This dude's like, it's just... It was just, dude, it was awesome. Like it was great. Like it was a literal bucket list moment thing for me. Another moment for me is also in 2022, I was the drum tech for Nothing More, and huge Nothing More fan. I'm not a drum tech, but I am a lifelong drummer. I understand I have the perfect toolkit to be a drum tech. It's just not my career aspiration. A good friend of mine who was the drum tech needed to step away to attend to his family. And Nothing More takes their crew team very seriously. It's not just like, oh, whatever. Anyone with a skill set can come and go. Like they want to have the same people for every single tour, every single time. So him stepping away was a big deal. And the band needed to feel comfort in who his replacement was going to be. So it meant a lot that he brought me in and that they embraced me. That tour was like 58 shows. It was a lot. I was also fortunate enough to like, I shared tour bus with Sleep Token that entire tour. And at the time they were like the opener for the opener, and they played a 4-song set, and it was just like, that in 1 year they became one of the biggest bands in the world. So that was very encouraging. First of all, it's just super cool to get to know them. But like, for anyone listening, anyone who's struggling with music or basically anything in life, but I guess this example is specific to music, so much can happen in 1 year. And yeah, that applies to every single year for the rest of your life. Like, and sometimes it'll feel like nothing changed, but that doesn't change the fact that so much can still change the next year. Like, don't think about this as like, what's going to happen in the next decade? Like, truly profound shit can happen from year to year. And Sleep Token is an amazing example of that. Anyways, last show of the Nothing More tour, headlined and sold out the Machine Shop in Flint, Michigan. And they asked me to play a song with them. And it was awesome. If there's a video on the Fear of Water Facebook page, it's actually pinned to the top of it. It's like Johnny introducing, he's like, we have never done this before. Like, we've never played this song with Dave before. Like, but whatever, we love this guy. We're going to do it. And the whole crowd's like, Dave, Dave, Dave. And then the song starts. And it's just like, I felt like God, dude. I felt like just king of the world as soon as that kicked in and just beating the shit out of the set. And I'm looking around, I'm like, I'm playing this fucking song with one of my favorite bands in front of a sold out crowd. And just like, it's like heroin, dude. Like, it's yeah. It's profound. Like, any of those kinds of experience, like any good show is intoxicating. Or like, you know, I've been on stage at like Louder Than Life and Aftershock, like standing in front of 70,000 people looking at you is wild. It's wild. I don't know how else to describe it. I've made this half joke before where I just like, I understand why dictators get off on like having an army of people like,
yeah,
super locked in on it. And then like, it's not just staring. It's like, there is an actual like primal energy of when the music you and your bandmates are making are literally guiding the movement and emotional state of an ocean of people. There's nothing else in life that is like that at all. Nothing that comes even close. And there is, it's a two-way street. Like, it's very cool being in the crowd when you just know there's an electric energy that's spreading throughout everyone when everyone is in that flow state. Like, this is an amazing moment that we're all a part of. And it's very cool being an audience member, but being on stage and looking out while it's happening is like, I don't know how to describe it, man. It's other than intoxicating. It is.
Yeah.
Like a drug. It is truly. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, to flip that question around then, is there a show from your entire career you would say was the worst experience, and how did you overcome it?
Oh, dude, there's so many. Dude, there's literally so many. It's hard to hard to choose. Like, if you play enough shows, especially early on, man, like, I can't say enough about the importance of your crew and how integral that is for a show sounding good and running smoothly. But then, of course, the vast majority of bands out there don't have a fucking crew. The band is the crew.
Yeah.
So, most of it's during that phase where it's just like, and especially when it gets into like the realm of technology, where like, if you're playing with a click track and you have like backing tracks and that shit goes down, like the computer dies or something in the middle of the song, like,
you're screwed.
Yeah, it's not good, man. I mean, I've had this reoccurring dream for my entire life where I'm playing drums in all these different scenarios, like at Red Rocks and in my grade school auditorium and in my basement or in front of some hot girl or whatever. And the drum set like disintegrates. Like as I'm playing, like the cymbal, I'll hit a cymbal and the fucking stand just like flies across the room. And then like the kick drum beater like goes through the skin. And like, I have that dream all the time. I have this, and I'm sure that's emblematic of something bigger, but it's also very literal in terms of like having a gear malfunction while you're playing live is like a very scary, helpless feeling.
Yeah.
So, and it's happened a lot, man. And if you don't have like your trusty guitar tech, I mean, just literally just waiting to pounce up there and be like, new guitar, boom, jack, totally tuned, go.
Yeah.
It sucks, man. So like, I can't think of like one specific show because I've had so many shows
right.
Where shit has gone poorly. But I would say like that serves a purpose. Like it has given me thick skin. It's given me perspective. It's certainly made me appreciate the good shows. But you got to like earn your stripes. Like I feel like everyone needs to kind of get humbled by some shitty shows.
Definitely, yeah. And before we dive into the last couple of questions, then future plans, new music, gigs, anything you want to share with us?
Sure. So you brought up Systemic. That came out first week of February featuring Aaron Nordstrom of Gemini Syndrome. Just last week, I had a song come out called One Day featuring Heidi Shepherd from Butcher Babies. Incredibly proud of that song. I just had this is a first for me. I worked with a team of professional choreographers to make a like modern ballet interpretation of the song, which it's a very new experience. And it was interesting, like going through line by line of the lyrics with these dancers, and then also looking at like visual references from like other dance performances or kind of explaining what this means to me. And then them explaining to me, like, here's how I would embody that. And here's a camera angle that would kind of depict the tension and the push and pull of what you're talking about in this part of the song. And I'm incredibly proud of how that turned out. That I just released that yesterday. So definitely for anyone listening, go to Fear of Water, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram to see that. And then, yeah, man, I have 6 songs that are still being wrapped up. I mean, I have 2 completed songs. One is, featuring Clint Lowry. The other one is with Sahaj Chinkatin from Raw. And both of those songs are, I think, great. And just figuring out the release schedule of when the Clint Lowry song will probably come out next month, which I'm excited about. And I have a lot of music that is pretty much done, but we're still working on identifying who the featured artist is going to be for those and then releasing those. And then I just, I'm recording 3 new songs with Joseph McQueen, either at the end of this month or the start of next month. And he's a phenomenal engineer, producer that's worked with like Killswitch Engage and Howard Jones and Bad Wolves. And I really want to keep working. I want to keep doing this where I'm Working with a huge variety of artists pushes me to explore different sonic territory, and working with a variety of engineers and producers I know is going to force me in a good way to evolve. And you know, and it's also just like building the resume, you know, like this is my way of networking. I want to earn the rights to work with these people, and I want to meet the challenge and do the best I can possibly do, and then use that to open the door to the next, hopefully, you know, take a step up, get to that next echelon, go from the minors to the majors. So I'm going to be doing this for the foreseeable future, and, you know, just see where it takes me. I'm very big on like saying yes to what the universe throws my way, as long as it's, you know, not harmful or, you know, a bad thing. But like the Nothing More drum tech gig, like that, I wasn't seeking that. It's not, and it's not something that I want again. But in that moment, I was able to help a friend, and I got a ton of good experience about it. And I had that really amazing concert experience that I just shared with you. Like all of these good things came from saying yes to something I wasn't even on the fucking horizon. It honestly wasn't even a desire. Like if you ask me what's 50 things that I want to achieve with my music career in the next 5 years, like nothing even remotely close to the crew work would have been on there, but I'm still very happy that I took that opportunity. So that's my philosophy, and I'm going to keep doing this like creative endeavor one song at a time. And it already has and will continue to open up doors and opportunities and connections and conversations. So it's cool. Like I'm just in this really unconventional scenario where like, as I'm creating music and sharing it with friends and family and fans, and that in and of itself is great, but it's also like, it's like if you're paying attention, or if you can like be on this ride with me, that like as you're hearing this next song with Clint, it's like I'm sharing with everyone that like I'm literally, this is a bucket list achievement for me, and I'm so happy to like share it with everyone. But then also, as you're hearing it, like know that because I have achieved this, it's gonna take me to the next level. And it's just, it's cool being able to share that with everyone in real time. So I really don't know what's beyond that, what's coming next, but I'm gonna keep this creative path, and I'm really excited about wherever that takes me.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, I know we're all going to enjoy seeing where the next step takes you anyway. So the last couple, these are a couple of random fun questions. First off, what are you, besides music, what are you currently obsessed with?
I am a lifelong gamer. My parents brought home an NES from Japan a year before it was released in the States. And it had Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Super Mario Brothers in Japanese. And that was, the only other thing I'd played before was Pong. Right. Remember Pong?
Yeah.
So, it blew our minds. And even though like the menu screen and all the dialogue was in Japanese, we're like, I was like, this is what video games, I didn't even realize it was Japanese. And I was also really young. I just thought like, you know, in the same way that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles aren't a real thing, this language isn't a real thing. It's just, I get it. You're talking and you're just showing all these crazy symbols. Like, whatever, man, let's go fucking kill some ninjas. I remember my mom, I have a great relationship with my mom. And it's very funny to reflect back on childhood as an adult. And gaming is definitely one of those things. She was convinced that video games were like Pogs or slap bracelets or fidget spinners, where it's like, we're going to bring you this goofy computer thing back from Japan, and you're not going to give a shit about it in 6 months. And 35 years later, I'm like, I fucking love video games, and she thinks that's hilarious, and I love that. But yeah, there's this game called RoboQuest right now on Xbox, and it's one of those games where you can play it over and over again, and you're achieving something new each time, building out on your weapon base. I look at my musical skill set this way, is that like I'm doing a lot of the same things over and over, but I'm constantly getting better and working on what I'm weak at and strengthening what I'm good at and like achieving new things. And that type of game is super appealing to me. So yeah, that's to answer your question, video games.
Right. I like it. The next one's a bit of a weird one. If you had to spend 24 hours locked in a room with any musician from history, who would it be?
It would not be Charles Manson, I can tell you that. Did you know that Charles Manson was like good friends with some of the Beach Boys?
Yeah. Didn't they steal one of his songs?
Yeah. And he like, the Beach Boys might be responsible for Charles Manson being a fucking serial killer. Yeah. But he wanted to be a Beach Boy so bad. And there's this whole like flower child version of Charles Manson. He wanted to be a folk musician. He wanted to like good vibrations, the whole thing. Like he wanted that so bad and that didn't work out. So
he went a little crazy.
But to answer your question, it's hard because there's that saying like, don't meet your heroes. A lot of people will probably have this experience at some point in life, but like people should not be surprised when you meet someone that you admire or maybe are even obsessed with because of what they do. Do not make the mistake of thinking that that is reflective of them as a person. If someone's a phenomenal actor or someone made your favorite song, that doesn't mean that they're like a fun person or maybe even a nice person. I hope that doesn't happen to people, but I have several experiences of meeting specifically musicians that I'm excited about. I'm like, oh, dude, you kind of suck. But the thing, there's also like, I just thinking about this, like mechanically, like they don't owe it. I'll just use it myself as an example, but this applies to everyone. Like they don't have to be, I mean, human decency says you should be a decent person, but like this has nothing to do with like friendship. And I think social media has only made this worse where people have this parasocial connection of like, oh, I see your posts every single day and I've gone to your show. So if I meet you in person, I feel like we're friends, but like, you're definitely not friends. And I think you should separate the art from the artist. So all of that being said, I think Dave Grohl is the answer because he does seem like the perfect blend of, from a musical standpoint, someone who again has been a lifelong inspiration for me. And there's so much of that that I would want to focus on, but he just seems like a fun human being that I'd want to like have beers with for 24 hours. I'm sure there's some like historical answers that would be interesting, but like, maybe John Lennon is really boring. Maybe Jimi Hendrix is an asshole. Maybe, there's all these, I think there's a lot of historical stuff that I'd be tempted to answer, but I think I'm going to go with Dave Grohl. He'd just be fun.
I like it. And the final one, what is your go-to album?
Is there any more to that question? It's so hard to just like, it's like I have go-to music that I sleep to. And then I have go-to music that I like. So the song Determined by Mudvayne is like my go-to. I'm ready to fucking rip someone's head off and shit down their throat, either literally or metaphorically, like to get myself pumped up. But maybe just in terms of well-rounded, just for the enjoyment of music, I know that whatever state of mood I'm in, what I have going on, there's a few albums like Animosity by Seven Dust, to me, front to back, perfect album. Wasting Light by Foo Fighters, front to back, perfect album. The Fragile by Nine Inch Nails is a double album that was very controversial in terms of it was arguably a bad commercial decision for them. It's coming off of The Downward Spiral, which was Grammy nominated, Closer, still their biggest song of all time. I mean, it literally solidified Nine Inch Nails as the fact that Nine Inch Nails, that Trent Reznor still has a career, is deeply connected to The Downward Spiral. And then he waits 6 years to put out The Fragile, which is this very avant-garde double disc album. It's not just a long album. We're still in the world of the physical medium. So putting out a double disc album is very expensive. And so you're like, hey, I have a new album out. It costs $35. That's going to have an economical impact. Like, you aren't going to sell, period. Unless you are, I think maybe the only band that did this well in our lifetime is Smashing Pumpkins, when they came out with Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. I think that was either as successful as Siamese Dreams or more. But Nine Inch Nails did not achieve that. Like, there is no hurt or closer or head like a hole. There is no defining career song on that entire double disc album for Nine Inch Nails, but it had, it came out at a very important time in my life. It covers a lot of emotional ground. I think in terms of like creating sonic landscapes, it is such an interesting collective piece of art. And then even though I listen on, you know, this now instead of swapping out disc one for disc two, I still listen to it as the opus of this
album.
That is, yeah, exactly. So I'm sure there's other albums, but those, I think, importantly, are the ones that came to mind because they're just, in my mind, irrefutably perfectly crafted pieces of art.
Perfect. Perfect. Listen, Dave, it's been an absolute blast now. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
But it's better not to pretend, 'cause I know I can't stop what I fear, 'cause I know one day that you won't be here.
Living today, and yet I feel something still.
Hey guys, I really hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please rate and review us on iTunes and Spotify. And if you're interested in signing up to Band Builder Academy, use the link in the show notes below and enter the code CONCERTS and you'll receive 10% off. So, until next time, keep rocking.
Hey, what are you guys still doing here? The show's over. It's over. You can go home. Go on. We'll see you next time. We'll be here. Bye.